This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. I'm thrilled today to be joined by Dr. Gary Kaplan. Dr. Kaplan's the Chief Executive Officer, and I think perhaps still the Chairman of the Virginia Mason Health System in Seattle. He's got a remarkable record of achievements in healthcare and a remarkable presence. We're going to talk to Dr. Kaplan today about the Virginia Mason Health System. We'll talk to him about healthcare reform. We'll talk to him about advice on having a great career. He's been recognized countless times. Dr. Kaplan, it's a privilege to get to visit with you today. Can you take one moment to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me. I am Gary Kaplan. I'm a practicing internist, internal medicine physician, and I've been at Virginia Mason Medical Center for 43 years, my entire career. I started as an intern, and for the last 21 years, I've had the privilege of being CEO. And now with our new merger with CHI Franciscan, we have created Virginia Mason Franciscan Health, and I have the privilege of serving as co-CEO with Kajol Patel.
Well, what a magnificent career. And take a moment, because you've been at Virginia Mason for 43 years. You've led it for the last 20 years. Let me let you take a moment to talk about a few points of pride in the Virginia Mason Health System, Medical Center, and so forth.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things that I'm most proud of is really our willingness 2 decades ago to look outside of healthcare for answers to some of our most challenging issues around quality, safety, patient and team member experience, and financial performance. And one of the things we're most known for in recent years is our Virginia Mason production system, which is how we apply traditional lean thinking and the Toyota production system to healthcare. We've been at it now longer than anybody in the world. It's had tremendous results. And since 2007, we've had the Virginia Mason Institute, which is really how we transform, help other organizations embrace this management system through education and coaching. We partner with other organizations both across the United States and around the world to put in place impactful, sustainable changes using this model. So that, I think, would be one area of tremendous pride. The second area I might mention is, although we were well along on this journey, we came to realize that we had significant opportunities to further our culture, particularly on the advice of people like Paul O'Neill and Lucian Leap, to actually take a deep dive on respect and respect in the workplace. What we found was, despite being a highly evolved organization in many respects with a culture we were very proud of, there was still subtle disrespect. And so we put in place mandatory respect for people training across the organization. And it's really, I think, helped solidify our culture as one that is highly respectful and allows people at all levels of the organization to do their very best work. And then the third would be translating all of this, the culture, the Virginia Mason production system, into the quality and safety domain. And through our patient safety alert system, which was modeled after Toyota's famous Stop the Line programs, we've been able to really create a leveling of the hierarchy, which allows all team members to feel safe, to all team members to be safety inspectors. And the result has been the ability to demonstrate unprecedented levels of quality and safety sustainably over decades now, and being one of the very few hospitals in the United States to get an A safety rating, for example, from LeapFrog, every single period in which these ratings have occurred. So building that culture from the boardroom to the front line has been critically important to us. So lots of sources of pride, but those are a few.
And those are big ones. And a tremendous amount has been written about the Virginia Mason management system and program and safety records and so forth. So great points of pride. You've also spent a good deal of time thinking about healthcare reform. And I know this is a long and vast subject, but I'll tee it up for you for a moment. We've got this great system with some gaps. We've got a great system, but with some inequities. We are still 30 million short of people that don't have coverage. And even with coverage, we need to get to access will remain a huge problem. What are some of your big thoughts? And I don't want to, I know it's a big subject, we've spent so much time on it. A couple thoughts on how we start to improve further the U.S. healthcare system.
Sure. Well, I think unless we expand coverage, and you mentioned coverage, Scott, which unless we really find ways to effectively expand coverage, we are going to be kind of in a circuitous cycle of what some have called chasing our tail, so to speak. I see inequities and the lack of universal coverage as a fundamental defect in our healthcare system that needs to be addressed. And that can be addressed, you know, through a variety of methods, which then gets us to the question of central planning versus market control, market forces. And I think, you know, our track record is not very good on having a market-based healthcare system succeeding. I mean, if you have cancer or if you need highly involved technical interventions, there's no place better than the United States. But as we know well, we fall far behind other countries. And so in most of our preventive health status metrics. And so we have not had a great track record. And so I think we need to look at some hybrid of market-driven systems, but with some central planning. I know that's not a popular subject with many of my colleagues in the industry, but I think we've got to be honest with ourselves. We don't have transparency between the end user, the so-called buyer and seller, which makes it very difficult to have a true market a driven system and reap the benefits of a market-driven system. And so I think we need to be looking at hybrid systems. We need to open our minds, whether you're on the Medicare for all side or on the strict market-driven system side, I think we need to look at coming together to actually get the kind of movement that we haven't been able to achieve to this point. And that includes not just quality and safety in a consumer-driven metrics that we tend to focus on, but also bending the cost curve. That is critically important. And without it, I think we are going to be looking at the reform that's taken out of the hands of the provider sector. And rather than being part of the solution, we will basically be the victims of the solution. So I think we've got to change some of our thinking in some substantive ways.
Thank you, Dr. Kaplan. For those, there's this great misunderstanding, I think, sometimes between universal coverage versus universal health care. Because you can get to universal coverage, we're 9.9%, 10%, somewhere around there away from universal coverage. And, and it's not to political one way or the other. Part of that gap was closed. 17 to 20 million people were closed, got coverage through Obamacare. And of course, 80, 90% of that really got coverage through expanded Medicaid. So there's a lot of ways to close that coverage gap. Medicare is only 14% of the population right now. So the complete disruption to change it to Medicare for all, that's just one way to do it. But there's a lot of ways to get universal coverage. But I think most people at some point, right or left, would start to come to the conclusion that we probably need to get to universal coverage. And then the next question, and I think most people are getting there, regardless of your politics, that somehow or another we have to find coverage for everybody. And I think for a lot of people thinking, if Medicare is only 14% of the universe right now, probably not to turn the whole system over at least right away and make it Medicare for all, but people have different opinions on that. It becomes a very big politic and talking point, but there's a lot of ways to get there. And I think more and more people, right and left, and right and left, 80% of people agree with the public option concept, which I know Washington's a state that's advanced in that area. And then 80% of people believe, right or left, that you should be able to get coverage regardless of pre-existing conditions. And so then you get past universal coverage to this next issue you're talking about, which is central planning versus not. And it's a fascinating discussion because obviously, you know, aside from the next question, which is safety and value, without somewhat, we have some central planning now. And in terms of how many residency spots we have, how many medical schools we have, medical schools are a little bit market driven because you've got great institutions building medical schools, but we don't have enough residency spots. And so somehow or another, we already have a system that's 50% or more paid for by government. And I don't know that I would advocate as strong as you do for a central planning, but there's obviously some need for more central planning because we've got looming shortages of primary care specialists, nurses, everything, with an aging population of 330 million people.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Scott. I mean, let's put central planning as the number one priority. I think we have to have guardrails. We have to have objectives that jump the curve over very segmented special interests. So the public option, you know, the commercial health plans, you know, hate the public option. So how do we ensure that, you know, workforce planning, which is the example you just brought up with medical students, I think we have some of the same issues with advanced practitioners. How do we have some sort of national imperative to create these residency positions that are going to be required in order to make sure we meet our supply requirements going into the future. So this just, it's a very good example of how we can merge market forces in some sort of guardrails or central planning that will help us get alignment. Because right now we've got, you know, the haves and have-nots are a zero-sum game. And I think we've got to get out of that zero-sum game thinking so that we can make the kind of breakthrough changes that have to happen.
And your point on the insurance companies of the public option is right on. We view the public option as having a post office. So if you don't want to use UPS or FedEx, you got someplace else to go. And what's really happened is anybody that doesn't have a job or doesn't have a direct employer that has tried to buy coverage through one of the big payers finds it's worse than buying a car, and right, quite frankly, over the long run, a lot more expensive, and it's right, and it's brutal. I mean, even if you're trying to build it under the, if you're trying to buy it under the ACA plans, it was challenging. Let alone outside right of that, it's just absolutely brutal. And so, more and more, I think the right and left embraces, you know, trying to figure out the cost of it, and that not, you know, and making sure the economy and the country doesn't go bankrupt. But I think more and more people very much are in favor of, and I do, and not to politicize, I do think President Biden in his plan to incrementally move Medicare from 65 to 64, 63, those kinds of concepts, I think those are a lot easier for people to understand and to digest than swift
big movements. No question. I think Medicare for all is not achievable in the near term. And that's why we need a migration pathway to get to these, to the universal coverage, to get to the right supply-demand equation. And then, frankly, I actually go back to my systems engineering approach in that there is so much waste. And if we have brought systems engineering principles to every sector in the healthcare ecosystem, we would find tremendous opportunities and a lot of low-hanging fruit.
Let me transfer you to one other set of questions before I let you go.
Sure.
You've had a remarkable career, one that's involved a big pivot from practice to leadership and maintain some level of practice too. I mean, really a remarkable career. I mean, and I would, any advice for people trying to have a remarkable career?
Sure. I think it starts with some attributes that Some may come naturally to some people, but I think can very much be learned and taught. And it starts with what I see as one of the great leadership competencies, and that is curiosity. Be curious, ask questions, recognize that we don't have all the answers. And despite some of the things, like in my training, in medical training, you know, the doctors as solo actor has all the answers, that's not really a pathway to becoming a successful leader. You have to, I think, you know, so-called level five leadership, identify what's important, have fierce resolve around those priority issues, but couple it with the kind of humility that comes, that is necessary to genuinely be curious. And part of that means listening carefully. That was something I learned over time. I mean, I early in my leadership career, you know, I wanted to have all the answers. And we talk about the so-called capes who kind of swoop in and solve problems and then move on to the next problem. That's the old leadership model, but it really doesn't build the kind of capability that I hope to teach and to leave behind with the people that I'm working with and helping to develop as leaders. And then the last is figure out who the right role models are and watch them carefully and take on the mantle yourself over time so that you can become a mentor. One of the most rewarding and opportune leadership or learning experiences that I've had is actually when I've had the privilege of being a mentor. It's the same thing, educators know this, they talk about all the teaching of the students, but in many ways, the students teach us and help us be lifelong leaders. So I think those are just a few thoughts that come to my mind as I reflect on things I've learned along the way.
I think that concept of when you're in a teaching role, many of us that have been in teaching roles in any part of our lives have quickly learned that being in that teaching role is the very best way to learn for a whole variety of reasons. You learn from your students, but you're also forced to think and put your thoughts together, so you learn as well that way too. So many different ways. I love the reference to the level five leader. Jim Collins talks about the level five leader, then the level six leader, and so forth. You know, few of us can get to be that anonymous level six leader where we really are able to leave our ego fully at the door. And it's really a challenge. It really can be a challenge for people.
Yeah, and I think you know, I wish I have a saying. I think it was my father, and he probably didn't originate it, but it was, I reserve the right to be smarter today than I was yesterday. And I think that's something that, you know, as I reflect back on my career now, having been in leadership for so many decades, I wish I knew then what I know now, because I think you know, you learn with experience, and so that's something. Being a lifelong learner is critical to being an effective leader.
Dr. Kaplan, I want to thank you for joining us in the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. For those of us and those in the health system leadership, and I'm an observer rather than being in health system leadership, Dr. Kaplan's one of the most well-thought of CEOs in the country for a very long period of time, and not to date you, but 43 years at Virginia Mason, but literally one of the most recognized, and has done just a magnificent job of leading a system that is known for greatness. So, Dr. Kaplan, a great privilege for me to get to visit with you today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, you're very kind, Scott. It's my pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.